So, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, you missed a great session. I'm going to speak about meditation. I was speaking a bit yesterday, mainly about the reasons why people meditate. First of all, therapeutic reasons to reduce stress. Secondly, to train the mind, to enable the mind to concentrate more effectively. Thirdly, to find more out about the nature of the chattering mind, the things that hook us up. And then fourthly, to connect with something beyond our everyday mind. Maybe Purusha from a yoga point of view, maybe God, maybe Buddha nature if you're a Buddhist, that sort of thing. But basically the everyday self isn't everything. That's what we spoke about yesterday. Today I want to speak more about exactly the different kinds of ways in which you can meditate, because the theme is Vinaya Yoga meditation, which is the appropriate application of meditation, the appropriate choice of meditational techniques to help an individual or group of people. And so that's what I'm going to look at, the different ways in which we can meditate, give you some models for thinking about that. And time permitting, I'm also going to speak about what surrounds meditation, what you can put in place surrounding meditation to allow you to aid the meditation and aid the sense of focus. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. And then we're going to do the same practice as yesterday, as promised. Okay, and then tomorrow we'll do the same practice once more. Okay. I'll go through it again, because I think there's a few of you maybe who weren't here yesterday, so I will go through it so that you, and a reminder for those of you who maybe haven't remembered every single bit of it. So that's what we're doing. So, first of all, the different ways in which we can meditate, different approaches to meditation, to help think about how you would choose. When I was thinking about this, first of all, what meditation is about, it's basically fundamentally about where and how you place your conscious awareness. So your mind is a magnificent thing that can do many things at once. However, your consciousness can only focus in one direction at any given time. So you can do things outside your consciousness, but your consciousness can only focus in one direction at any given time. And so meditation really is about making a conscious choice about where to focus that consciousness and what direction to point it. Because so often, as we find, when we're practicing meditation, or even if we're observant at other times in our life, we notice that our consciousness, we are not masters of our consciousness. Our consciousness goes where it will. And the idea of meditation is try to achieve a certain amount of mastery over our consciousness, to train it to go more in the directions that we want it to and less in the directions we don't want it to. So that's really what meditation is about. It's an attempt to place, making an effort to place your consciousness in a particular direction, in a particular way. Okay, and I think there's kind of three aspects. When we're thinking about how we place our consciousness, there's three aspects which I'm going to speak about. The first aspect is the nature of the thing that we place our awareness on and the characteristics that it has. And in particular, I'm going to go into quite a lot more detail about this, but basically, the nature of the thing that you place your awareness on affects how easy or difficult it is to keep your awareness in that direction. Some things are easier than others. Some things are easier generically for everybody than others, and some things are easier for some people than other people. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, how the choice of the object, the direction that we place our mind in, affects how easy it is to go in that direction. And secondly, the nature of the awareness that we place. So our awareness, our consciousness, is a very interesting beast which can focus very strongly in one direction. Like, for instance, if I say, focus on the tip of your nose, you can feel your tip of nose. And if I say, now be aware of your entire body and the sensations through your entire body. So you can, awareness can be very tightly focused, or it can be more diffuse and more broadly focused. So your awareness can be kind of willfully placed in one direction, or more diffuse and be open to, be more receptive of a larger number of sensations. And that's, to an extent, that's something that happens, but it's also something that we have some degree of control over. We can make a decision about whether to focus our awareness or attempt to focus our awareness or to allow our awareness to be more open, more broadly. So that's the second thing. So the first thing is the nature of the thing that you place your attention on. The second thing is whether your awareness is focused or diffuse. And of course, there's, you know, a range there. And the third thing is your attitude to the inevitable failure of your effort to put... Okay, so those are the three things, and I'm going to speak more about all of them. First of all, the nature of the object. Secondly, the nature of the awareness you place. And thirdly, your attitude to your inevitable failure. Those are the three things we're going to look at. Okay? So first of all, the nature of the object that we place our mind on. So the object, there's many different kinds of object. Object is, as those of you who are in Hilary's session, object isn't quite the right word. As Hilary said, it's kind of a generic term. It's a kind of a generic term for the where you place your, the direction you place your mind. Object makes us think of something physical and concrete, and it's not really that. It's more abstract, more varied than that. And so the first thing, if we take one example of the way that you can place your mind, something that is not, it is actually a form of meditation, but we don't really think of it as meditation. And that is concentrated thinking about a problem. And so, for instance, a mathematician who concentrates on solving a problem is in a form of meditation. Not necessarily the highest form from a yogic point of view, but nonetheless, it is a form of meditation. A mathematician who really or an accountant really getting into the accounts and doing the accounts and focusing their awareness and really thinking about what needs to be done. So basically, putting your awareness in a certain direction, but thinking about what you're doing and doing something actively that involves concentrated thinking is a kind of meditation. And so that's something that many people who wouldn't consider them meditators do as part of their work or whatever. And that is a kind of meditation. And to a certain extent, it's one of the easiest kinds of meditation because the effort to solve the problem is always pulling you back to it. Okay, so it doesn't mean you don't get distracted, but you're really aware when you're not focused on that thing. You notice, I've been staring at this spreadsheet for the last 5 minutes and done nothing. You know, you kind of become aware. So that is a kind of... and I think if you think about it, the highest form of that, someone like Albert Einstein is a really good example of someone who really engaged in that concentrated thinking and allowed quite deep insights to arise because of that concentrated thinking. And I think Albert Einstein is, you know, a genius... but also beyond the genius, he had insights which kind of go beyond this normal form of thinking. But nonetheless, this normal form of thinking, concentrated thinking, was very important to him. So that's kind of really focusing the mind on one thing. And now I spoke about how the mind can be really tightly focused or it can be more diffuse. And so this is allowing thinking process to arise. But also you can take an object of focus, which is an idea, and allow thinking process to arise in a more diffuse way, not having to concentrate on solving a particular problem, but allowing more insights to arise, more openness to more kind of interesting ideas that arise by looking at a certain kind of idea. And that is something that's often referred to as contemplation. So where you maybe you take an idea and you see how that resonates for you. You allow thoughts to arise. They might come up. And as long as those thoughts are to do with the thing that you're contemplating. So it might be the nature of God. It might be... Navtej yesterday, we were doing... So this isn't quite... But Navtej was speaking about forgiveness. And we were doing a contemplation linked with the breath around forgiveness. So it's kind of constrained form. So coming up with kind of ideas and thinking about allowing your thoughts to come, but your thoughts are constrained in a certain direction, but not quite as constrained as if you're concentrating deeply on solving a particular problem. So you're open to insights that come in that way. So that's actually kind of allowing the thinking mind to do its stuff, do what it's used to, but not allowing it to be pulled in by distractions that come. So that's the kind of first kind of meditation. The next one that I want to think about is that thinking mind is, as we all know, the part of us that is most often in our foreground of awareness. It kind of busies away. And the techniques I've spoken about so far are trying to get it to busy away in a more productive fashion than if we just leave it to its own devices. So then the next technique is to say, okay, it busies away. Let's keep it busy with something which ultimately has no purpose from a purely thinking point of view. So we keep the verbal mind busy, but the busyness, the thoughts, so the verbal patterns that are going around are not really linked to conscious thought. And so a really good example of this is mantra and chanting, that sort of thing. So where you're using the verbal mind to do something, and you're focusing on doing that thing, but the actual content works on a deeper level. It's not that you're thinking about the mantra, but the mantra fills your mind, fills your talking mind with something else to talk about. And that something else to talk about stops the everyday chatter. Okay, so that's chanting is a very good example. And then mantra as well. And I was going to share with you a technique that I learned from a monk in Thailand. I was literally passing through. I was actually between New Guinea and India. I was on my way to the Mandaram. And my mother had a PhD student. She taught a PhD student who was a Thai doctor and a medic. And this Thai woman looked after me just for 24 hours. And my mum told her a little bit about me. And then she decided where I'd go. So I was given a whistle-stop tour. And it was very different from your normal tourist experiences. Like, she took me to see a collection of pickled mass murderers that they... So, like, she obviously decided that would appeal to me. But she also, knowing my interest in meditational practices and Buddhism, she took me to meet a monk who couldn't speak a word of English. And he, very quickly, he gave me a technique. And the technique that he gave me, which is a very preliminary technique from their point of view, was very mathematical, because he probably knew, she probably said that I was, you know, kind of mathematical kind of person. But it's something that clears the mind quite effectively by making it work on a problem which is pointless but difficult. You see what I mean? So what he made me do is, so I'm going to do it out loud, but obviously do it internally. You count from 1 to 5. And you keep on repeating that pattern, but each time you take out the numbers in order and put them at the end. Okay? That's what you do. So I'll just do it. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 1, 3, 4, 5, 2, 1, 2, 4, 5, 3. Do you get the idea? Okay. All right, I won't ask you to do it then. yeah. No, it's not a problem. It's just simply counting. It's just simply counting, but moving things out. So it's that you have to pick a different one. So it's quite tricky. So if you lose your attention, you will very quickly stumble. And it's the same with Vedic chanting or something like that. If you lose your attention, you notice, because your thinking mind is kept busy on something which is fundamentally not about what you're thinking about, if you see what I mean. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that is a very effective way of making the thinking mind stop doing its busy stuff. And also, as soon as you fall down, you notice. Yeah, as soon as you fall down, you notice. Okay. So that's using using filling the verbal mind, keeping it busy with something which stops the everyday chatter. And like that previous technique I find very effective when I'm, you know how you can wake up at 3 a.m. and worry about something completely stupid? That's a technique that I use sometimes then. It's just to clear my mind of that crap that comes up at 3 a.m. To help get back to sleep. So that's using the verbal mind to clear the chatter of the verbal mind by filling it with something. And the fact that you're doing something which is active, keeps you on that tightrope balancing, okay? And so you know when you stumble. And the next thing that I want to look at, the next thing I want to discuss, is a similar thing where you are active, but this time your awareness is not placed on the contents of the verbal mind, okay? So I'll give you some examples of that. You're very familiar with them. So asana, particularly moving asana, is a great example of where you are active. There are things that you need to do, but the things that you attend to are not the contents of your verbal mind. You need to place your awareness on the flow of the movement, the flow of the breath, the careful movement of the spine, etc. And so one of the reasons why asana is so effective, particularly moving asana, particularly the way that Desikin Shah so skillfully taught it, is that this this slow and steady movement, which you must pay your attention to, you must keep your awareness on it, keeps the mind busy, but not with verbal thinking chatter. Okay? Having said that, so the technique I spoke about before, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and chanting, etc., is quite difficult to think because your mind is so full. Okay? With the asana, when you start getting used to it, when you've done forward bend, you know, flank forward bend 1,000 times, it becomes second nature and becomes easier to do it on autopilot. And so that's the kind of risk with this second approach, is that you need to bring a freshness to it. And that freshness can be through the breath. It can be, so for instance, many of you, I'm sure, have done the approach where you've been doing asana for a little while with breathing, and then maybe Paul Harvey or someone else has said, make the breath longer than the movement. And suddenly that brings an extra level of something which grabs the attention. Okay? And so by adding layers of the onion to grab the attention, then you can keep that freshness while still doing the same thing over time. Another example of that kind of thing, so pranayama, similarly, you're consciously engaged in doing something, but the thing that you're doing is not verbal. And so it holds the awareness, particularly in the early stages, but there's the risk that the mind is going to go wandering off and think about the shopping list, even though it looks like you're doing a perfect Nadi Shodhana to the teacher. Okay? Yeah. So you need, part of the skill of the teacher and the student is to bring life, always bring life back to that practice, to make sure that your awareness stays there. Another example of that, I gave that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 example, which was using the mind, the verbal mind. But another one, so that's something that I, because I'm sort of, you know, my mind is sort of rational, logical thing connected. What do you think about that practice, Marion? Is that something that would appeal to you? No, I didn't think so. Whereas I find visualization challenging. I know I've spoken about this with Marion before. I find colour visualization very challenging, whereas for Marion it comes quite naturally. Am I right? Yeah, this is what we've spoken about in the past. So this next one is one that I would find more challenging than the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but I suspect Marion will find it easier. And that is to visualize the colors of a rainbow, one at a time, flowing into each other. So you start off with red, and then you allow it to change to orange, and then to yellow, then to green, then to blue, and then fading into the dark indigo, and then finally to violet, and repeating it round. See? And so that's something that, again, holds the mind, keeps the mind active, but not involved in something that is a thinking process. It's a non-verbal process. And so that kind of thing can, again, if you fall off the perch, you notice you've fallen off the perch. It's easier to notice that you've fallen off the perch when you're doing that sort of thing.
Can I ask a question? Something about you mentioned thinking, and I find it hard not to call that thinking.
Right, okay. So maybe I should say verbal thinking. That is non-verbal thinking. That is non-verbal activity of the mind. Yeah. The visualization, yeah, non-verbal activity. So when I was using the word thinking, what I really mean is the mind talking to itself. You see what I mean? Yeah. Because as Miranda was saying earlier, the mind talking to itself is part of what gets us into a lot of trouble. It's the stories it tells itself. So that's the kind of making the mind active, but the mind is focused on something that is not a talky sort of thing, not a thinky sort of thing. And then the next stage, in terms of, I suppose you could say, challenge, is a similarly focused awareness on something. But this time it's something that is not changing, that you're not willfully changing. So in the asana, you're willfully changing. A moving asana, you're willfully changing. That rainbow flow I gave you the example of is you're willfully changing from thing to other. But focusing on something that you're not willfully changing. And so one example of that is what we did yesterday, where you're holding the image of the sun or the moon. It's not something that's willfully changing. It's something that you're open to. And that is more challenging than the willfully changing thing, because if your mind drifts off, it's easier not to notice that you've drifted off. Other examples of things that you can do, so images. So a traditional thing in India would be the yantra, which are, some of you might be familiar with, the kind of sacred patterns which represent a sacred space or a temple almost, and quite complex images that you could hold in your mind. One that's popular, say, with the British Wheel is the candle meditation, looking at the flame of a candle. Being aware of the breath as it comes in and out is another example of that. Being aware of bringing your attention to the point between the eyes, the third eye point, and keeping your attention there, again, would be another example of that sort of thing. So there's different things. Yeah, sometimes they're visual. Sometimes they're to do with sound. Sometimes they're to do with feeling. So different sense modalities can be connected with these choices. And that's kind of more focused. But also you can have more integrated but diffuse awareness. So a sensation, a feeling of the entire awareness of the entire what's going on in the body, which was one of the things that Miranda spoke about this morning, a sensation of what's going on in the body. Another one, which is a Tibetan technique, which they call landscape meditation, it's normally done outside, is where you're sitting and your awareness is on your entire visual field. So it's not that you're focused on one thing or another thing. It's that you allow your awareness to be present on the entire visual field, not focusing on any one thing. And you're simply present to the sensation of what is in that visual field. And the idea is you allow the part of your mind which says, cow, tree, grass, to kind of fall away until there's just this sensation of a visual field in front of you, an unlabeled visual field is what that practice is. So it's designed, the idea is that the point of concentration is the visual field, but you have it in a kind of integrated awareness as opposed to a focused awareness like you'd have, say, with the candle meditation. So that's kind of a feeling of the different sort of things that we can place our awareness on. Things can be something that actually involves the thought, deliberately involves the thought. It can be something which is active, that the mind needs to do things, or it can be a still or passive thing where the mind is observing, holding something specific, like an image, a still image, or being open to receiving, say, sensations in the body, etc. So thinking, active, or still or passive. And then the other thing is, as I spoke about, is the awareness. The awareness can be focused tightly on one thing, or, which is almost more willful, or it can be more diffuse and receptive, which is more about surrender to what arises. Okay, so that's thinking about those things. And then the third thing I spoke about, that I said I would speak about, is the attitude to the thoughts which arise in the mind. And this, I remember I spoke yesterday about the four reasons why you might meditate, the therapeutic reason, to train the mind, to find out more about the way the mind works, and to discover what's beyond the mind, to connect with what's on beyond the mind. Your attitude to the moment when you get distracted really profoundly affects which of these approaches that you're taking. Not the therapeutic one. So the therapeutic one, all of these different attitudes are okay. But for the other three, the attitude to the thoughts that arise determines, to a certain extent, which direction you're going in. So if you are trying to train the mind, so the focus on the object is an act of tapas, then the moment when you are distracted and bring your mind back to that object is effectively a failure, okay? But it's a failure that, as I say, is inevitably going to come. And so you bring your mind back. You're training your mind to be present for as long as possible. And so the attitude, if you're training the mind to be strongly focused on something, then when your mind is distracted, you bring it back, and you're endeavouring to always be bringing it back. Okay? So the second thing is the mind, basically, if we are interested in finding more out about the contents of the mind, which make up our personal self, our stuff, then the moment when you are distracted is an opportunity to observe the nature of the arising distraction. So the thoughts that come up, what you find is, say you're focused on whatever it is, the sun, the moon, your breath, whatever, and thoughts arise. And what you see is, so one technique that's used, for instance, in some of the Buddhist practices is to label the thoughts. Okay, I'm thinking shopping list, crap thing that happened when I was a kid, you know, that sort of thing. Things come up. And you notice the patterns. You notice the things that arise over time. And that act of noticing the things that arise allows you to become more aware of the patterns in your mind, in your everyday mind, the patterns that hook you into life, in both good ways and bad ways. And so by noticing the thoughts that arise and the games that your mind plays at that time gives you insight into the nature of your mind, which you can apply in everyday life. Am I being clear? Yeah, okay. So this is that. So those moments of thoughts arising are opportunities for insight into the games that your mind plays. And the games that your mind plays are the games that your mind plays. They're not the games that my mind plays. So my mind plays different games from your mind. Okay, the same general kind of scheme of things, but the particulars are down to my particular personality. And so you discover the way that your personality gets hooked into the human condition. That's what you find out through that. And then, so that's the second way. So that fits in, as I said, with understanding yourself. So if you want to understand yourself, the important thing is to observe the nature of the thoughts that arise and distract you from your effort to concentrate, because profound insight lies in those patterns. And then the third approach is what linking with something beyond your everyday mind. And Miranda spoke about this morning, even though she was talking about the kind of mindfulness-based, well, from a therapeutic point of view, Miranda touched on this absolutely. And the what's beyond your mind, what's beyond your everyday chattering mind, is what you observe through the thoughts, even when the thoughts arise. Okay, the thoughts, they don't take you away from that thing, but they hide it. And so when there's less thoughts, it's easier to see it. When there's more thoughts, it's not so easy to see it. But nonetheless, that thing that one is, which is not the everyday mind, what is behind the everyday mind, can be observed through the thoughts. And as a result of that, if you want to make a connection with what is beyond the everyday mind, then the attitude you adopt to the arising thoughts is to see them as simply things that arise and are not so important. Okay? So it means that Miranda used the image of the clouds in the blue sky. So the clouds are there, but you are still aware of the blue sky. An image that I like, which comes from the Zen tradition, is the image of a lake with great depths. And the surface of the lake can be stormy on some days and nice and peaceful on other days. And your job is not to make the lake peaceful, though it's nice to have a peaceful lake, let's not deny it, it's nice to have a peaceful lake, your job is, even though it's stormy, still make contact with the quiet depths of the lake through that storm. So that means the attitude about to the arising thoughts is, those thoughts arise, but those thoughts are not what I am. They're part of me, but they're not my entire being. I can make connection with what is beyond. And what is beyond is the space in which the thoughts arise. Or another way, that's almost a Buddhist way of putting it, but it can be the Purusha, or the divine. So seeing through those thoughts that the divine is still there. The thoughts might hide it, but the divine is still there. And you can still make connection. If you have a certain attitude to those thoughts, you can still make connection to that, even though the thoughts come and go. Okay, so those are the three different attitudes to thoughts arise. And different attitudes are appropriate at different times. If you're struggling with... it's kind of... The first is about training, tapas, effectively, tapas of the mind. The second is about understanding the contents of the mind. So you could call it swadhyaya, which is self-study, to find out more about what goes on in your mind. And the third is linking with something beyond. So you could say it's Sushruta Pranidhana. It's linking with something beyond the mind. So that's kind of the connecting it with the idea of Kriya Yoga and the Yoga Sutras, for those who know the Yoga Sutras. And each of those is appropriate at different times. If you're struggling with stuff and you want to have some insight into why you're making these mistakes all the time, then observing the thoughts that arise, the patterns that arise, is really valuable. And as Miranda said, being accepting of them, not thinking of them as something to be rejected as bad, but just being accepting of them. And simply observing them and being accepting of them makes them change naturally. Your relationship with them changes, again as Miranda said this morning, your relationship with them changes. Okay, so those are the three attitudes. So I've spoken about the... what did I say? I can't remember what I said. I spoke about the nature of the object which we place our thinking on, object in the very generic sense, the way in which we place our awareness from... I spoke about focus versus diffuse, but in fact, as I'm sure you're aware, it's like a continuum. You can be highly focused, focus on the tip of your nose, you can focus on your face, you can focus on your entire body, you can allow your awareness to be diffuse around the room. So it's kind of a continuum, it's not a simple either-or. And finally, our attitudes to arising thoughts. Those are the three things that we spoke about. So next, I want to just say a little bit about... what do I want to say about? The vessel which holds the meditation. So as I said yesterday, one way of thinking about meditational practice is thinking of it as like a plant. And it's planted, it starts off as a little seed. And over time, it can develop and grow into something that's stronger. And the vessel which holds the meditational practice, the pot in which it goes, is what provides protection to it. And the most important thing when you're protecting your meditational practice in the early stages is, so the whole idea of, so what is anathema to a meditational practice is everyday busyness. Everyday busyness is what saps a meditational practice of its life, okay? Everyday busyness. And so to create a... to provide that protection to a meditational practice, you create some kind of framework which allows you to give a sense of stepping out of everyday busyness, particularly the desire to achieve stuff. Okay, and the ultimate vessel for a meditational practice is to go and live in a monastery. Okay, because a monastery or a temple is effectively designed to try a routine, so I think this is probably true of Christian ones as well, but it's certainly true of Buddhist ones, designed to create a routine which re-engages you with the meditational awareness at all points in your day, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep. So Miranda spoke. So in fact, Miranda, I seem to remember that you used the example of brushing your teeth as something that's kind of, you use it as an example of a sort of modern thing. But in fact, the first example I can think of that might even be earlier ones is 8th century China. There's examples of meditations around brushing your teeth. So it's actually, I think John Kabat-Zinn has very skillfully looked at the entire Zen package and thought about how it can be moved into a modern context. But in a temple, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, there are little rituals. And these rituals are designed to, first of all, say, this thing I'm doing, no matter how mundane and profane, I'm doing for the good of all beings. And secondly, I will be aware of this thing that I'm doing. So whether it's brushing your teeth, whether it's going to the toilet, whether it's chopping the vegetables, all these things. In fact, for the moment you wake up, you say, awakening this morning, I am awakening with all beings, and I dedicate my actions today for the good of all beings, that sort of thing. So the moment you wake up, that's the in a Zen temple, that's what you would do. You would say this little mantra, effectively, and your awareness would be focused on. So the whole package is designed to hold you there, okay? So that's the ideal. So I want to say something about that, because that is, you know, that's a wonderful ideal, and retreats are what we can get close to that. If you go on a retreat, so this environment is kind of, you know, it's a bit loose, yeah? Okay, from a retreat point of view, but you've been on yoga retreats. Some of you have been on yoga retreats. We're a bit tighter, okay? A bit tighter. And that tightness, that rhythm of the day, encourages you to always be coming back and to that sense of being away from everyday life. And that rhythm holds you brings you back to a state of awareness and state of focusing on what you're on. So that's what we get. That's what we get. We can't live in temples, but we can at least go on a retreat and have that certain sense of focus. What time do we finish? Is it 6:30? Is it?
6:45.
6:45, good. And that, because I'm not behind time, that's all right. Phew. Thank you. Those of you who were chanting this morning know that I finished half an hour early this morning accidentally. So the other thing I want to say about the temple, temple life, is temples are wonderful places for creating that environment, but one of the worst things that can happen in a temple is it can become corroded by worldliness. And a temple that becomes overly corroded by, you know, you're playing games of spiritual ambition inside there is just as bad, if not worse. My second Zen teacher, one of his favourite expressions is, ambition is not a great thing, and spiritual ambition is the worst of all. The idea that you can achieve mastery, particularly, you know, kind of being a fantastic teacher, fantastic yoga teacher, or fantastic Zen monk, or whatever, is corrosive. And that can happen in these. So I don't want to paint some rosy picture of these temples being perfect places. But part of the game, which I'll come on to in a moment, is that you must work with these worldly things, observe them, and by observing them, maybe reduce their power and impact to corrode. So I'll say very briefly, I think many of you will already have experienced this. The ways to kind of create this is to create a special place where you can practice, even if it can't be a permanent special place, at least clearing away the worldliness for a little while, shutting the door to the children, you know, that kind of thing. Just creating a special place that you can be. So, and that already creates that certain sense of separation, which allows the meditational practice and the yoga practice to grow. And also, Miranda spoke about earlier on, is even in everyday life, we can have moments where we can visit. She spoke about the doctor with the green dots. Creating things that bring us back out of the everyday busyness and remind us that we can connect with the meditational state of mind in some ways is deeply valuable, deeply valuable. And the other thing I want to say is sangha, the community. The community, having community, having people who you have relationship with, both as peers and as your teacher or teachers and as your students, is profoundly supportive in this way. Again, if you are observant about the way that we can still play games in the spiritual world. But nonetheless, it's profoundly supportive to have that sangha to support the practice. And these things allow you to protect the seedling of practice. And I like to like the image of with the seedling, you've got your seedling growing up, and to keep the deer off, you have a little fence, a little fence around it. But as it gets bigger, you can take that fence away, and you can take it out into the world more. You can the awareness that comes in the practice is something that you can link with, even in far more worldly situations, whether it's a business meeting, whatever, you know. And a fantastic example for me, one of the most worldly and unpleasant environments one could be in, it was, I think it was 2 days after Christmas, I bought my brother one of those ice cream maker things, you know, that's kind of whirs around. I bought him that for Christmas. And when he'd opened the packet, it had broken, all this green gel had come out. And I bought it from Argos. So I went along to Argos with my wife Ilsa, who some of you know, to take it back. And of course, it was 2 days after Christmas, shopping mall, heaving with people. Yeah, some of them who are taking things back, you know, lots of, you know, argy-bargy, all this sort of thing. And I was in the queue like this. And I looked over and I saw Ilsa, and Ilsa was just standing there like this. And afterwards I said, "What are you doing?" She says, "I was meditating." Oh, yeah. So even in Argos, it's possible. Even in Argos, it's possible. So you know, you can still make connections with things. Particularly, as I say, the more... the stronger the practice is in you, the easier it is to connect with in harder, in more challenging environments. And I was just to be clear about the nature of the challenge, it's, you know, all the worldly stuff. But the things that are most distracting, obviously it's things that are demanding your attention and asking you to do stuff is the worst. But then putting those aside, also if you're in an environment where basically other people talking, that's the hardest thing to deal with, other people talking. So noises like traffic going past is easier to deal with than other people talking, because your mind gets pulled by the talking. So trying to get to an environment where other people are talking. But nonetheless, with practice, the seedling can deal with other people talking. The seedling can deal with the teenager next door playing his hi-fi on full blast, Led Zeppelin or whatever they play nowadays. Yeah. So the training is what's important. So that's about the vessel. So creating the vessel and thinking about creating the vessel. And the other thing to say is, from a yoga point of view, and we do this a little bit in the practice that I'm doing, and Hilary, who taught earlier, those of you who went to Hilary's session, was also doing it, is surrounding the meditation with ritual is a good thing to do. Having some... in the West, we're maybe not quite so keen on ritual. We're a bit too modern for that sort of thing. But you know, surrounding it with ritual can give it a sense of... meaning and separateness from the everyday daily life. And then that separateness allows you to take it back into everyday, because then you can be in the world but not of the world with your practice. It doesn't get corrupted by it. And so creating a little ritual, a bit of asana, a bit of pranayama, and also in kind of the structure that I was giving you, but many different structures are possible. And as both students and teachers, it's our job to innovate and think about what's appropriate in these different situations. It's the same in a temple, in both a Hindu temple or a Buddhist temple, that the act of ritual as you arrive and as you leave remind you that you're entering into a sacred space, that it's different from the everyday world. And part of the reason for those little rituals are to allow you to make a transition into a place where you can be more meditative. Tomorrow, I would very much appreciate your questions and thoughts. If you'd like to, be great if maybe you could write them down, or they can come spontaneously. But anyone who wants to suggest things beforehand, it will help me just think about it a little bit beforehand.